From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! A moment of shame for all Americans. That's what many are calling the welfare bill President Clinton will sign today. We'll talk with two critics. A conversation with the presidential nominee of the Natural Law Party. We'll visit the site of a burned church that people have gathered to rebuild.
Well, I look at it this way, that in November 1938, they burned down the synagogues in Germany, and the international community didn't do anything, and the Germans didn't do anything, and that was really the last time to stop the Holocaust. And if they had done what we're doing here, which is just make sure that churches get rebuilt and getting the money and the volunteers and the effort to redo it, we got to change the racial climate in this country, and this is one step to doing that kind of thing.
And why is the Democratic National Committee not doing more to get black students to vote? All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. In a few minutes, we'll talk about today's top story, President Clinton's plans today to sign the welfare repeal bill. But first, these other stories in the headlines. Democrats are fleshing out whole speak at their convention, which begins on Monday, and the Republicans say they'll be ready to speak, too. Two-time presidential hopeful Jesse Jackson will be the first major speaker on Tuesday. He has sparred periodically with President Clinton, most recently over Clinton's decision to sign the welfare repeal bill that ends the federal guarantee of assistance to the poor. Democrats also announced that 9 female members of Congress will make presentations, 5 senators will speak on Wednesday night, and 4 House members will speak Thursday afternoon. First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton will be the final speaker on Tuesday, and Vice President Gore will speak twice, once Wednesday, then Thursday, to accept renomination. How does billionaire presidential candidate Ross Perot invest his money? His latest financial disclosure reports the Reform Party candidate has invested more than $450 million in foreign government bonds. Perot has criticized U.S. companies that move overseas. He didn't list any foreign bond holdings in the report he filed for his 1992 presidential bid. 6 Democratic Congress members yesterday asked the Supreme Court to delay the reshaping of their districts in Texas until after the fall elections. The Congress members complain they have not been given enough time to adjust to the change and want the fall elections to proceed under the old boundaries. The Supreme Court ruled in June that the Texas legislature improperly drew 2 districts in Houston and 1 in Dallas to create a majority of voters who are black or Hispanic. And Bob Dole is pressing President Clinton to release his entire medical record. A spokesperson for the Dole-Kemp campaign says the president owes a full accounting of his medical history to the American people. And this news following up on a story we read yesterday in the Washington Post. The Clinton administration chided Senator Carol Mosley Braun, Democrat of Illinois, yesterday for not seeking a State Department briefing before embarking on an unannounced trip to Nigeria earlier this month. Mosley Braun, in defending the trip where she had tea with the military dictator's wife, said that senators should not be prevented from meeting with leaders around the world because of some interest groups in Washington. Human rights activists complain that the trip could help legitimize General Sani Abacha's authoritarian regime, not to mention the execution of Ken Saro-Wiwa and others who supported the Ogoni cause. And this news on broadcasting. Federal regulators approved television network plans for giving free airtime to presidential candidates, despite complaints that minor candidates likely will be left out. The Federal Communications Commission's 4-0 action yesterday allows Fox, ABC, and Public Broadcasting Service to move with their plans for this fall. The action exempts those networks from federal rules requiring equal access for all legally qualified candidates. Is that any surprise? After all, the FCC is run by a Clinton appointee. And of course, Clinton is a major party candidate. You're listening to Democracy Now! Today, President Clinton will sign the welfare bill, ending 60 years of federal guarantees of aid to the poor. In so doing, he's outraged a number of his traditional constituencies — unions, women, immigrants, religious groups, and children's advocates. Marion Wright Edelman, head of the Children's Defense Fund and a personal friend of the Clintons, released a scathing condemnation of the president yesterday, calling the bill the biggest betrayal of children and the poor since the Children's Defense Fund began. She added, "This act will leave a moral blot on his presidency and on our nation that will never be forgotten." Joining us now are two people who are fierce critics of welfare reform, at least as we know it today. And they are Rosemary Dempsey, Action Vice President of the National Organization for Women, who participated in a meeting with high-level White House officials last week and will be part of a demonstration today outside the White House. We're also joined by Debbie Weinstein, Director of the Family Income Division of the Children's Defense Fund, which focuses on strategies to move families out of poverty. Well, Rosemary Dempsey, you met with high-level officials last week within the White House. How are they defending themselves?
They really didn't attempt to defend themselves. The people that we met with are people who we have been working with for months to attempt to come to a very different end. These are the folks within the White House who, I believe, struggled mightily against this decision of the president. These are the people, one of them, Alexis Herman, who has been a tireless worker against poverty and for decent welfare, a decent welfare system and decent welfare reform in this country for over 20 years. They didn't attempt to defend it. I think there was a half-hearted effort to rally this group of women's organizations to say, we want you to help us make it better. We want you to serve on some task forces and soften the blow. And frankly, around that table, there wasn't anybody at this point willing to do that.
Now, I think this is a very important point, this idea that the Clinton administration has been putting out. And I should say, by the way, that we asked for a Clinton administration official, someone possibly from HHS or from the White House, Health and Human Services or the White House, to join us, but none did. But this point that President Clinton is raising, and we've heard Congress members who defend the welfare repeal bill raise, that if he is reelected, he will change some of the components of this bill, and he's trying to recruit all of you to help him do that. But what if he is not reelected? And what if there isn't a Democratic Congress? Then this bill goes as stands.
You know, I people have come so far from the point of we have to hold our nose and vote for Bill Clinton. I don't know exactly where we'll be in November, but I can tell you that most organizations and most individuals and people around the country, some people who are very major donors to the Democratic Party and formerly to the Clinton campaign, are saying right now, we are very angry at Bill Clinton and we don't know whether we're going to participate in the presidential election. The reality is that this is a person who in 1992, I can remember literally dancing in front of the White House on the evening, around 10 o'clock midnight of Election Day, because we really believed that this meant that in terms of quality of life issues, in terms of issues around economic justice, that the country was finally going to start going in a progressive direction once again. That simply hasn't happened. I think this is unforgivable. It's more unforgivable of a Bill Clinton. And what one may wonder is maybe this is what we need as a clarion call to wake the country up to say, hey, this has got to be a central issue to all of not just to our organizations, but to the consciousness of the American people.
I have a letter in front of me from Wendell Primus. He was a high-level official within the Department of Health and Human Services, and it is a resignation letter. He says that it's truly been an honor and privilege to serve you. He's writing to Secretary Shalala and work alongside the many dedicated, compassionate staff at the department. Then he goes on to say, I believe strongly that a political appointee must be able to support the administration's policies that fall under his purview. Given the president's decision to sign the welfare reform bill, I have no choice but to resign. To remain would be to disown all the analysis my office has produced regarding the impact of the bill. And it's signed Wendell E. Primus. Again, he has resigned from the Department of Health and Human Services. His boss is Peter Adelman, Assistant Secretary of Health and Human Services. Is this the same Peter Adelman who is the husband of Marion Wright Edelman, the head of the Children's Defense Fund, who has so seriously blasted President Clinton. She said this is a shame on all Americans. Let me put that question to Debbie Weinstein. You work with the Children's Defense Fund.
Yes, he's that's right. You have the relationship right.
And he hasn't resigned.
Not as far as I know.
Well, why don't you tell us a little about what the Children's Defense Fund is going to do? This is one of the strongest press releases I've seen in quite a while from an establishment group here in Washington. Marion Wright Edelman saying, and to remind you folks, she was a close personal friend of the president. President Clinton's signature on this pernicious bill makes a mockery of his pledge not to hurt children. She goes on to say this act will leave a moral blot on his presidency and on our nation that will never be forgotten. Today marks a tragic end to our national legacy of commitment to our most vulnerable children. This is truly a moment of shame for all Americans. So here her husband is clearly, if he has not resigned, supporting what the president will be doing today, signing off on the welfare repeal bill.
The main issue here is why this bill hurts children, and that's what I'm here to talk about. This is a moral blot on our nation and on his presidency. This is a moment in which we are choosing, for the first time in my recollection, to knowingly go about setting up a policy which will make more than a million more children poor, 2.6 million people poor, that will not only hurt people who are currently on welfare, but will hurt working families who are trying to make ends meet. And that's one of the things that is very little talked about in this, that will deprive those families of nutrition aid, that will deprive children with disabilities of assistance, that will take legal immigrants who have come here playing by the rules, who have really no prospects, and remove the basic survival needs assistance for them. You know, it's hard to know how to convey the seriousness of this, to wake people up to the seriousness of this. And, you know, all I can say is that there's a quote from somebody in the Clinton administration today to say, now we've ended welfare, next comes the step of doing real welfare reform. What could they be thinking of? You know, what casualness is there to tear down something that is the only survival safety net for millions of children in this country? And then, you know, maybe something will happen later. Maybe they'll be able to put some kind of corrections in place. There wouldn't be this casualness about interest groups who have some power in this country. That's the lesson of this, that children have no power, that women have too little power.
Well, what about this idea of ending welfare as we know it as being such a good thing? I was interviewing New York Congressmember Nita Lowey a while ago, and she would have been one that would have been opposed to anything like this. In the end, she voted for it, although she opposed the previous bills. And when we asked her why, she responded that this was the last chance during Clinton's first term that he would be able to end welfare as we know it.
Well, I think clearly, if this was decision, this was a decision, and I think the sources within the White House confirm that this was a decision made with the advice of what we maybe not so affectionately refer to as political hacks,
and Dick against Morris and the White House,
and against the advice of the people who are the experts, the people who have been working on these issues, the people who were at our cabinet level. And senior advisor positions. It's a terrible mistake. And one of the things that I think has added to the ability of the president to make this mistake and the ability of his advisors to tell him it's a good political move is that we have not seen in the press the absolute seriousness of the blow. We keep hearing, and I don't say Pacifica, it's different about this, but most papers will say, oh, all it's doing is shifting the money from the government, from the federal government to the state governments. What it's doing, and as Deborah says, is taking away the promise of this country to its people that no matter where you live in this country, you have a right not to starve. You have a right to a cash entitlement if you fall upon hard enough times, and that is just plain devastating.
Well, what about their argument, the administration's argument, the Republicans' argument, that's all one at this point, that this acts as a disincentive to people to help themselves, and that's why they've put a cap of 5 years on anyone receiving welfare in their lifetime?
It's nonsense.
You know, the majority of people on welfare have work experience.
Debbie Weinstein.
People want to work. And what they can't do is stay in jobs because half of the women on welfare, and they are almost exclusively women, have not finished high school. They can't successfully compete for jobs in this economy, or they live in areas where there aren't jobs. They try to work, and in fact, what we're seeing now as the economy has moved upward in the last couple of years, there has been a real reduction in the welfare caseloads because when there's a job out there to be had, women on welfare will try to take it. The problem is they can't afford child care, and when their child care arrangements fall apart, they'll lose their job. They'll be the first to be laid off as soon as the economy turns down. So real reform gives them a chance to really keep that toehold in the labor market, and this bill doesn't do it.
You know, it's interesting. Many have contended to the administration that they want all of this protest from all of you because President Clinton wants to prove, they wouldn't say his Republican credentials, but his credentials as a centrist. There's a piece in the Washington Post today on welfare, which I found quite interesting, where they quote a senior administration official saying, "We're not trying to pull a sister soldier," referring to Clinton's criticism of the rap singer during the 92 campaign. Clearly, here was President Clinton using African Americans as a backdrop to attack them as he stood in front of a chain gang of black men with Senator Nunn and had a photo opportunity. What about that idea that this is good for him, that you're here protesting what he has to say? It'll just reinforce his credentials for the people he's trying to get to vote for him.
Well, number one, what he's doing, and this is always an argument within campaigns, and particularly within the Democratic campaigns, is he is taking the people who are his base, and I don't believe that these folks understand how deep it's cutting. The people who are the base, who are not just the poor, who are not just people who are falling upon hard luck times, not just progressive women's organizations, but a much deeper swath into the base of the Democratic Party, the people who do the fundraising, the people who do the get-out-the-vote work, the people who set up the phone banks, the people who perhaps are not going to switch their vote to Bob Dole, but they may indeed not just not work for Bill Clinton, but in fact not vote for Bill Clinton. When we were sitting around that table, now is sort of considered, I think, by a lot of, and maybe rightfully so, I guess we're even a little proud of the fact that we're not considered your typical inside the Beltway or the organizations. We're often seen as too idealistic, too unwilling to compromise. And many of the allies that we were meeting with on Monday are folks that we've had struggles with before about compromising too soon. These were folks whose constituencies, whose major donors, whose financial base is not just the folks who I think the Democrats think that they can take for granted. It's much deeper than that. And the reaction to this is very deep, and it will become deeper because we're not going to let go of this. People are now saying, look it, we voted for Bill Clinton because he promised something. And now he's voted against a major, major portion of that. And we're going to hold him accountable. And we're going to hold him accountable right through this presidential election.
Does someone like Ralph Nader become more appealing to groups like National Organization for Women so much so that they go out and actually campaign for him?
I don't think the National Organization for Women's PAC is going, at this point, is looking at endorsing any presidential candidate. We're certainly not going to endorse Bill Clinton.
Did you last time?
No, we did not last time either because of his certain stands in the area of reproductive rights and at that point, quite frankly, some of the things he was already saying about welfare. But at this point, a lot of our members, particularly in California, are looking very seriously at Ralph Nader.
The Republican convention and the Republicans in charge there were very proud of the fact that they were able to squelch all dissent by the time the convention actually happened. This was beyond the platform hearings. What about what's going to happen at the Democratic National Convention? Will you be there? Will there be protests? If those protests happen, will they just be in the protest pen, as in the Republican convention? Will you get inside the convention? Debbie Weinstein of the Children's Defense Fund.
I won't be there. There will be some people from the Children's Defense Fund there. I don't know exactly what will happen. There has been talk about people exercising their right to talk about why they oppose this. There has been that kind of opposition raised in other settings at the president's birthday party. I think that people feel deeply about this, as well they should, and we can expect that people will talk about it and welcome that.
The president clearly sees his signings of a number of bills this week as a counter to what he's doing today, signing health care portability, signing off on the increase in the minimum wage. Your thoughts on that? Now, Senator Murray Dempsey.
I don't think it offsets it. I think, you know, the minimum wage, this increase still doesn't bring people up to the poverty level, even if they will work full-time at a minimum wage job. And insofar as the convention, there are definitely going to be voices raised, both inside and outside. And I think if the Democrats were smart, they would not do what the Republicans did. They, in fact, if they're smart and they want to see the congressional candidates elected, as well as perhaps Clinton having a shot at reelection, they would be very smart to allow people from the podium to express their thoughts on this matter.
Well, we'll see. Among those people who will be speaking are Jesse Jackson, who has spoken out against welfare repeal. We'll see if he will do this from the convention floor. Now, thank you both very much for joining us. Rosemary Dempsey, Action Vice President of the National Organization for Women, and Debbie Weinstein, Director of the Family Income Division of the Children's Defense Fund here in Washington, D.C.
Can I just say that at 12 o'clock today, we're going to have a demonstration in front of the White House and urge everybody to join us.
And I'll say we'll be out there covering it. We'll bring it to our listeners tomorrow. And up next, we're going to be hearing from the presidential nominee of the Natural Law Party, then a look at the Southern churches being rebuilt. You're listening to Democracy Now! This is Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman. This year, with the second presidential candidacy of Ross Perot and the first Green Party presidential nomination of Ralph Nader, more attention than ever has been focused on alternative party candidates. Depending on what state you live in, you may in fact face a choice among six presidential candidates if you vote in November. One candidate who's been flying almost unperceived beneath the mass media radar screen is Dr. John Hagelin, a physicist running on the Natural Law Party ticket. The Natural Law Party is running more than 1,000 candidates for federal and local offices this fall and is holding its annual convention here in Washington this week. Pacifica's national affairs correspondent Larry Bensky spoke with Dr. Hagelin yesterday at that convention, which drew about 100 delegates.
Dr. Hagelin, what is, in the shortest possible definition, natural law?
Natural law to me as a scientist is the intelligence of nature. It's the laws of nature that uphold human health, uphold our complex ecosystem with millions of mutually interacting species. And there are laws governing societies and economies as well. The Natural Law Party was designed to put the most up-to-date and complete scientific knowledge of natural law in programs taking advantage of that knowledge to work immediately in government.
Science, in one of its definitions, is the ability to replicate experiments, that one experiment can be replicated by somebody else and therefore called proven. However, social science never seems to be able to do this. Why do you think that natural law does this when other social science philosophies haven't been able to?
Well, even among sociological phenomena, it is possible, although more difficult, to conduct scientific experiments and determine, for example, what works in the areas of public health and economy and so forth. So the Natural Law Party does take an empirical approach. We support programs that are effective and have been shown to be effective in published, peer-reviewed scientific journals. There are programs, for example, in the healthcare area, which have to do with people, not as hard a science as, for example, elementary particles, but nevertheless which have been shown to reduce health costs by promoting health. So in the same way, we apply the scientific principles to test the effectiveness of programs before we admit those into our platform.
Karl Marx said that he was a scientist, too, and scientific socialism, in one of its variants, derived from Marx. But the bastardization, one might say, of Marx's philosophy did not prove to be one that was able to organize humans for the great of good of all for all time. Why would natural law be able to do what Marxism failed at doing?
Well, I think our standards for science today are a little bit more rigorous. We have journals that are peer-reviewed by objective scientists, and if a program works, it works. Now, it may take several replications of a study to show that a program really does save money, really does solve a crucial problem, and until that program works, it's not going to be supported by the Natural Law Party.
What is the relationship of transcendental meditation to the Natural Law Party?
Transcendental meditation is an example of a type of program, one of hundreds of programs that the Natural Law Party would support because it is effective and cost-effective in a specific area. Areas where the TM program, which is a powerful stress reduction program, have been very cost-effective are reduction of high blood pressure, according to the National Institutes of Health, and also reducing the rate of return to prison. Cutting back the rate of prison recidivism is a very effective, cost-effective way of reducing crime. So it has a place in our platform. It has to, because our basic philosophy is government should be based on what works, and if something does work and solves a crucial problem, we're for it.
It sounds like you're saying that a person has to be able to participate in transcendental meditation in order to get the benefits of what the Natural Law Party is talking about.
Not at all, except for if somebody wants to have the reduction of high blood pressure that the transcendental meditation could bring, yes, then they would have to practice that program. But remember, 98% of our party membership doesn't probably know anything about transcendental meditation or certainly doesn't practice it. This is a very, very broad grassroots phenomenon, the Natural Law Party. People like what we stand for, which is government should be based on what works.
Well, everybody says that, of course. You won't get the Democrats or the Republicans or any other party saying we want a government based on what doesn't work. What would work in your government that you think isn't working in theirs?
Well, I find, frankly, a lot of rhetoric coming from the other political parties. I think if the Republicans or Democrats had solutions to the problems of the country, certainly we would have heard about those by now. So, for example, the Republicans are talking about a steep tax cut to stimulate the economy. That's not a new idea. The Natural Law Party, for example, would support prevention in health care, which is a new idea. In fact, Republican and Democratic statute outlaws prevention from Medicare, Medicaid, and other government programs. That is, frankly, why we have the most expensive disease care system in the world and among the poorest health of any industrialized country. According to published research in the Journal of the American Medical Association, 70% of disease is preventable and self-inflicted. If that's the case, why do the Republicans and Democrats outlaw prevention and yet haggle over the financing of disease care?
Well, I think on things like preventative disease, on use of renewable resources, on being pro-choice, on abortion, all of which are contained in your 50-part platform, you'd find a lot of people, not everyone, who would agree with you in this country. However, you too, in your platform, advocate cutting taxes. And you too say that cutting taxes would lead to greater economic stimulation. It sounds to me pretty much like what Bob Dole is saying. How do you differ?
There is a difference. For one thing, you can't talk about tax cuts without talking about spending cuts. I haven't heard a lot of talk from Kemp or Dole as to what they're going to cut. The Natural Law Party, I believe, is the only party that can cut taxes responsibly. That means without cutting essential services and without adding to the budget deficit. But you've got to, in order to do that, you've got to be able to identify significant cost savings. One area of such savings is preventive health care. We can actually cut Medicare costs outright without taking away a single Medicare benefit, but by adding the benefit of preventive services that are known to prevent disease, promote health, and pay for themselves through reduced medical costs.
People, not just the Democratic Party, are beginning to do the math on the Dole-Kemp tax cuts, and they don't add up. You say that you could cut costs, yet I notice in your platform again you don't advocate cutting military costs at this time. What are you going to cut? You're not going to cut Social Security. You're not going to cut Medicare. You're not going to cut the military. Isn't that nine-tenths of the federal budget right there, or some high figure?
Well, firstly, it's not correct to say that we're not going to cut Medicare. Medicare costs will drop remarkably through our programs, but not by taking away Medicare benefits, but by reducing the frequency that people access and need those benefits. For example, Quebec introduced a program of incorporating prevention into their health care program, and what they found was a 6% per year reduction in their medical outlays. And remember, the Republicans and Democrats shut down the government twice this year over an argument over Medicare financing. Republicans wanted to slow Medicare growth from 10% per year to 6%. The Democrats said, no, we can't do that. That'll reduce the quality and affordability of health care for the seniors. The Natural Law Party says, no, you cannot just slow Medicare growth. You can cut Medicare costs outright with proven preventive programs. And $285 billion lay in the balance between the Republicans' 6% growth and the Democrats' 10% growth. Think of how many hundreds of billions we can save by cutting health costs at their basis.
There was a president named Bill Clinton who came into office with high ideas about changing the medical system in this country and came up, among other things, against a very well-funded, powerful health care and insurance establishment. How would the Natural Law Party get beyond those two massively well-funded and well-connected obstacles?
Well, two things. One thing, by incorporation of prevention, we're not directly threatening the insurance companies in that they can save money by keeping their subscribers healthier. But you are absolutely right. We are certainly going to not make friends of everyone. And there are very powerful special interest groups, including some of the medical pack, medical lobbyists, who won't like the concept of prevention in health care. So what we need to do, and what any political party desperately must do, is pull the rug out from underneath the special interests by disallowing their financial contributions to the reelection campaigns of our congressmen. Until we do that, frankly, none of the forward-looking, nourishing, prevention-oriented programs that we support will ever make their way through the Congress.
Well, speaking of money and campaign financing, you seem to have a fair amount of it yourself. In USA Today this Friday, you're going to publish a, is it 16-page supplement with your 50-part program in it? That isn't cheap to do.
No, I wish it were cheaper. Our hope is, and by the way, we have accepted and will not accept any PAC money in this campaign. Our campaign is supported by people. And what we hope is that this first USA Today insert, which will go to millions of Americans, will not only pay for itself by increasing the interest and enthusiasm for these solutions, but the contributions that we hope will come at the grassroots level will allow us to turn around and do the same thing in the San Francisco Chronicle, the San Jose Mercury News, the LA Times, and in every major paper across the country.
Well, I'm already donating to your campaign, aren't I? As a U.S. taxpayer, you are taking tax dollars.
Yes, we have what are called federal matching funds. We're the only third party to qualify for them in this 1996 race. And it means that small contributions to the Dr. John Hagelin for President campaign, my campaign, will be matched by the federal government up to $250. We have actually gained close to $500,000 that way in matchable funds. It's not the $30 million that the Republicans and Democrats will get through matching funds, and we don't get the $12 million that they pay themselves to put on their conventions. So we're just getting a pittance, really, but we make good use of it. We don't need $168 million to win this campaign. We could win this campaign on $10 million because our ideas are much more powerful.
People suspect that the Natural Law Party is a cult, that you are funded by the Maharishi International University organization, however it is expanding in the world or has expanded in the world, and that members of that organization are basically contributing funds that you are using for a political purpose. What's the truth about this?
The truth is, there is no organizational link whatsoever between the Natural Law Party and the organizations that teach TM, which are not-for-profit educational organizations. Not only haven't we received any financial contributions from those organizations, but we haven't even gotten an endorsement from those organizations. And it's the same with the sustainable agriculture businesses and so forth. There are a lot of people who have a lot to gain through our promotion of prevention-oriented, forward-looking, innovative new technologies. And we would be happy to receive contributions from any and all Americans who believe these ideas are timely.
Well, I notice in that USA Today supplement that's going to appear on Friday that a Fairfield, Iowa, which is where Maharishi, what is it now called? Maharishi Business?
University of Management, yes.
Thank you. Maharishi University of Management has changed its name. That a phone card group in Fairfield, Iowa, the same place, is advertising that a resort, which is called a residential and resort community called Heavenly Mountain, is advertising. Are these not businesses that are associated with the Maharishi's university?
Correct. These are not businesses that are associated with Maharishi University of Management.
They just happen to be in Fairfield, Iowa, and places like that?
Telegroup is a booming telecommunications company based in Iowa. The president of Telegroup is running for Senate under the Natural Law Party platform, but he has no tie to the university or any organization that teaches TM.
Now, you're fielding something like 1,000 candidates around the country, including, I believe, 32 for Congress in California and another 25 for state legislature in California. All of these people are going to have funding for their campaigns, in addition to you having funding for your presidential campaign. Where's this money coming from?
Well, again, there's not enough of it, that is for sure. Some of these individuals are quite successful in their own businesses. Some of them, university teachers or professors, school principals and so forth, have a natural support base, a natural constituency. They're going to have to be raising their funds locally from their own constituents because, unfortunately, there's really nothing left over at the national level of the party to support them or really even my candidacy to the point that I think it needs to be supported. We're just all making do. I mean, for example, Ross Perot, he had a legion of paid signature gatherers in Ohio in his efforts to get on the ballot there. He didn't make it at first, actually. He had to sue the state. The Natural Law Party made it with ease, without the deep pockets, without the legion of paid signature gatherers, just because people were willing to sign our petitions. And that's only because our ideas whose time has come, our strength is entirely in our ideas.
Well, let's talk about those ideas for a minute and get back to the 50-part platform on education, for example. And throughout the platform, as I read it in this USA Today supplement, I got a kind of a whiff of free market libertarianism, that you believe that if the free market were unshackled by regulation, things would be better. And in the education field, for example, you call for school choice and school vouchers, which are two of the principal dogmatic points that people who are libertarian to Christian right in this country believe in. What's your confluence of philosophy with those two strains, libertarianism and religious fundamentalism in this country?
Let's see. Libertarians believe in personal freedom, empowering people to make decisions for themselves. That is good on the one hand. But on the other hand, I think if you were to dismantle government today and deregulate the businesses, there wouldn't be a tree left standing. So the important difference...
There almost isn't already.
That's right. The important difference is we have a way to get from here to there. And the way to get from here to there, which means more personal freedom, more personal responsibility, is through better education. Education that keeps kids in school, because 70% of our students drop out in cities like Cleveland. Education that really harnesses more the creativity and intelligence of the American people. And that's why I'm for school vouchers and school choice. The socialized educational system that we've had so far isn't working. I'm a professor. I cope with the results that students enter my classroom every year who want to major in science or engineering and simply cannot without a year or more of remedial instruction. We have to introduce some competition into the educational system. This is my belief. And the other thing is educational programs that are more effective. And here I think the federal government has a role to play.
Wouldn't school vouchers, if they were done on the higher education level, directly benefit Maharishi Business University?
I don't know. I suppose it could benefit any private school, and hopefully all the public schools, too. Because until we introduce some competition into the schools, even if there were good educational curriculum innovations, I don't see the motivation right now for the public schools to get with it and adopt these programs.
What I'm getting at is one of the obvious, more transcendent motivations of the Christian right in pushing the school voucher plan is to support their own schools. Now, if inner-city children and poor children are to have real choice through school vouchers, those vouchers have to be worth a lot of money, and nobody's proposing enough money in those vouchers to really send a kid to school. $1,500 won't do it. How much would your vouchers be worth?
They would be worth as much as $2,500 so that at least the students could have a reasonable choice of schools, even a choice of public schools. I think even parents should have some influence over what school, public school, they send their children to. As far as the Christian right is concerned, I will say this. I've met with the Christian Coalition. I've talked to them at length about our platform. Certainly there are some differences there. But one thing is true. The Christian Coalition, a Christian right, does at its heart have the best interests of the country, and I appreciate them for that. And if they want to promote a voucher system that would allow people to choose a school that had a religious-oriented curriculum, I would say fine, as long as that curriculum meets the nationally accepted standards, and I'd like to see high standards for science, for history, for all the subjects we expect and need our children to master in this day and age, just to bring more competition into the system.
What about school prayer? Is that an element that you think is necessary to have in schools that would be improved?
I think the word prayer is frankly too sectarian for a public school system. I would strongly uphold the separation between church and state. I can see a moment of silence.
Meditation.
Silent meditation even, but not, when, as soon as you say prayer, it really gets more into the denominational area, and I can't personally support that right now.
Dr. John Hagelin is the presidential candidate of the Natural Law Party. For those of you who want to find out more about that party's platform, the Friday, August 23rd, USA Today contains a lengthy exposition of its program, all 50 points. Thank you for joining us on Pacifica Radio, Dr. Hagelin.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Up next, a look at the rebuilding of black churches in the South that have been burned and why the DNC isn't doing more to help register black students to vote. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. On their birthdays this week, President Clinton and Tipper Gore and their spouses went down to Tennessee to help rebuild a black church burned down in the epidemic of church arsons that has been sweeping the South. While some white churches have been burned, most have been rural black churches, and many of these crimes have remained unsolved. But a number of those arrested are avowed white supremacists. This summer, Quakers from Washington, D.C. have organized a volunteer work camp to rebuild several of the burned black churches. Martha Honey went to Greene County, Alabama, and has this report.
Thanks for the river. Oh, what a time, what a time. What
at noon every day, a half dozen women and a cluster of small children arrive at the Little Zion Baptist Church worksite. The women bring fried chicken, mashed potatoes, salads, greens, beans, and all the fixins. And they spread out a midday feast for the 40-some volunteers and local workers who are building a new church. While the workers eat, the women sing gospel songs.
Oh, I know I've been changed.
The angels in heaven and sun.
One of the cooks and the lead singer is Johnny Busby Jackson. She's a large woman whose family has for generations belonged to the Little Zion Church. And she recalls the night last January 11th when her church burned down.
I was at home, and one of my neighbors called me and said that the church was burning. And I said, no. She said, yes. So I looked out the door. I could see the light from the fire, you know, but then that was that. So my husband and I came over here, but it was all burned down when we got here, and that was about 9 o'clock, a little bit after.
What were your feelings?
Well, it was sad. To me, it hurt, you know, because this is supposed to be a sacred place.
In recent months, three other nearby churches have also been burned in this part of western Alabama, one on the same night as the Little Zion fire. No one has been arrested. But now new churches are rising from the ashes. Hundreds of volunteers from around the country and as far away as Tanzania, Yugoslavia, and Ireland have arrived here to help rebuild the churches. Sitting in the shadow of the nearly completed new church, Ms. Jackson calls it a miracle.
To me, it's the coming together of nations, you know, not color, but people, souls, hearts. You know.
The rebuilding effort is being spearheaded by Washington, D.C.-based Quakers. David Zarumka is a site coordinator overseeing the volunteers.
My job is to give them tasks and then to teach them whatever they need to know to do whatever they're doing. So many of the people, like a whole bunch of them, are rolling on paint today. And they started yesterday, and two out of the three people had never done it before. So, you know, teach them what to do and watch them a little bit. And then by now, they're pretty good at it.
So how would you say the competency is? Are they building a good church?
Oh, this is excellent. Very, very well built.
Zarumka says the project is doing more than building back bigger and better churches. It has a wider political significance as well.
Well, I look at it this way, that in November 1938, they burned down the synagogues in Germany, and the international community didn't do anything, and the Germans didn't do anything, and that was really the last time to stop the Holocaust. And if they had done what we're doing here, which is just make sure that churches get rebuilt and getting the money and the volunteers and the effort to redo it, you know, we got to change the racial climate in this country, and this is one step to doing that kind of thing.
On a Saturday morning, crowds of mostly black people gather outside the Civil Rights Institute in Birmingham, a museum which documents the history of the African-American freedom movement.
In Birmingham, Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth announces plans to challenge local bus segregation. His house is bombed.
This museum is built right across the street from the famous 16th Street Baptist Church, where in 1963, white segregationists exploded a bomb, killing four young black girls. That incident made the entire world stop and take notice of what was happening in the American South. Carolyn McKinstry is hanging an art exhibit in the Institute, and she remembers well the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church.
I was in the church at the time it was bombed. I've been a member of this church since I was 2 years old, and as a matter of fact, had just come up the steps and walked into the sanctuary when the bomb exploded. So I was 14 years old. And with this one, I lost four friends. So.
You knew the little girls?
I knew them personally, and one of them, Cynthia Wesley, and I were in a club together, a little social club. They were all part of the Sunday school, and we were all kind of in the same age group. So, you know, we all knew each other real well.
McKinstry says she spent years trying to put the horror of that church bombing behind her, and she felt the country had gotten beyond such hate crimes. But the recent wave of church burnings has rekindled her old fears.
I am deeply grieved. I guess I went through a period of my life where you always think things won't happen again. You think, surely this won't happen again. Nobody would do this again. And it became a very real thought, or it became very real to me that, in fact, it could and it was happening again. It's sort of like the ultimate in evil. Church burnings, church destruction. What America needs to understand is that all of this is not historically dead.
Back in Greene County, Spira Gordon is a black member of the county council and a longtime local leader of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, Martin Luther King's old organization. Greene County is over 80% black, and thanks to a strong voter registration movement, African Americans here did gain political power. But, Gordon says, economic power stayed with the whites, and many other things have not changed.
There are many, many vestiges of the old days. There are two swimming pools, for instance, and some folk would argue that, well, that's not discriminating because people can go where they want to go. Well, what's the sense of having two swimming pools if you're not trying to encourage separation? Clearly, the schools are separate. There's a private academy here, and there's a public school. And whites go to the private academies and blacks go to the public school. The churches are still basically black and white. There's a country club that's all white. There are doctor's offices that still have two waiting rooms, even though you can go to whichever one you want. And some of the attitudes are clearly still there.
All right. Excuse me just a second.
Yes. Buddy Lavender typifies the racist attitudes Spira Gordon is talking about. Lavender is the white mayor of Bowlergy, one of the tiny towns in Greene County. He has a long beard, dresses in army camouflage overalls, and is blunt in his views.
There's a day-to-day problem. We got no problem. You know, if outside agitation would leave us alone, we'd have more of a browning in the community instead of a black section and a white section. It would be a where we got a mixed section already.
So you mean there would be more intermarriage?
Don't believe in that. I really think that the Bible didn't intend for that, but I've got no objections to going to school with them or going to church with them or doing whatever. Working, I worked with them all my life. The last 65, 67 years, I've worked long beside of them. I'm not for interracial marriages.
When you talk
of, I don't think I'd be racist in saying that either, you know.
And when you talk about outsiders or outside agitators, do you believe that these people who've come down to rebuild the churches are also outside agitators?
Some of them are. The Quaker work camp come in here. They've caused some friction in here between the people with some of the things that they've doing. They might have done it unintentional, but they've caused a lot of friction between the races and what they're doing here.
Harold Comfer is the Quaker work camp director, and he and local contractor Robert Woodridge are discussing how to put all the volunteers to work.
We came down the 1st of June, and since we've been here, 11 more churches have been burned. The president has made it the hot issue of the summer, and our little sort of preschool work camp program has turned into a university with thousands of people applying. This is truly the Church Universal that has responded, and it's turned into a very necessary movement because of the large number of churches that have been burned and need help.
On Sunday mornings, volunteers in the tiny congregation for Mount Zion Baptist Church, another of the burned churches, gather for worship in a cramped office. Deacon Charlie Means, dressed in a white sports coat and white shoes, leads much of the service. He's a large man with a big smile.
You just don't imagine on a Sunday morning to walk into your Sunday school and you see 25 different white people. You see maybe 15 blacks. And when the Holy Spirit comes, it touches them just like it touches you. And I can't do nothing but thank God that I am alive and able to be in 1996 and to see this happening. You know, Dr. Martin Luther King spoke many times about he had a dream. And in his vision, he saw many, many things. But I'm one of the people to be able to be among the living, to live and see that his dream did become a reality, because I am able to sit with my sisters and brothers, and I'm able to sing with my sisters and brothers, white or black.
The church burnings, like the old Ku Klux Klan cross burnings, are intended to put fear into the black community. In Greene County, the poorest and most heavily black part of Alabama, outside volunteers have brought in a spark of hope. They are helping to rebuild both the churches and community spirits. Women and men, whites and blacks, are challenging Southern mores by working, praying, and breaking bread together. Whether this spirit grows into a new movement for social change and racial equality remains to be seen. But in the heat of a midsummer night, as hands are joined and voices raised around a circle, it does seem possible. For Pacifica, I'm Martha Honey in Greene County, Alabama.
And thank you for that report, Martha. Last week at the Republican convention in San Diego, not once from the podium did speakers mention the burning of black churches in the South. We'll see if the issue is mentioned at the Democratic convention next week in Chicago. You are listening to Democracy Now!, and in this last brief segment, we are joined by Tlaib Kareem, who is a communications lawyer here in Washington, D.C., rose out of the housing projects of Detroit, Michigan, and is the legal advisor for the National Youth Empowerment Movement that's based here in this country. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Tlaib.
Thank you, Amy. I want to definitely give thanks to the Creator for blessing us to get here to this morning, and thank you for inviting us on your show. Our organization is formed a group formed by students and young professionals like myself who are aiming to do three things, basically: educate, register, and mobilize over a million young professionals and students to get to the poll in November.
So tell me how the Democratic National Committee, which often pours money into voter registration efforts, what are they doing around getting black students to register? I was on a local show here at WPFW. We had a student from Howard University call in, and he actually said that they weren't doing anything. No matter what projects they brought to them, they would not focus on students who were the most likely to vote.
I agree with that student at Howard. Unfortunately, it appears as though they're doing basically what they've been doing in the history. That is, a lot of face and a lot of front type of front type of action, and no real tangible
action.
What
do you action. Mean, face and front time?
For example, they have brought students here to Washington, D.C. from black colleges across the country, and to state that, here we have all these colleges coming together, and yet they're not really giving the student governments the funding to promote voter registration drives in their own state. I mean, for example, there's few students across the country that even have voter registration cards. The National Voter Registration Card, which was created out of the motor voter law. There's few organizations, student government organizations who even have these cards. However, that's what they're doing. Despite what they've done, we are still registered over 1,000 young people this summer. We've been registering people at nightclubs. We've been registering them at concerts. We've been registering them at outdoor festivals like the Philly Greek Picnic and the Jones Beach Picnic in New York. I mean, these are the type of things that our people are at, and that's why I think it's important for young people to get to the polls, and that's why I think our organization, who is based here in Washington, D.C., is doing a lot of good work.
We were talking earlier about the fact that just in the past few days, last Sunday, President Clinton, for his birthday, they raised $10 million at his birthday party in New York City. I guess the question is, where is that money going? Have you spoken with people at the DNC?
Yeah, we have spoken to the person. They have a couple of, Black student, representatives. And so therefore, every time we call, they give us these people. And these people are basically, again, we've clocked in, meaning we've met with them several times, yet we've gotten no tangible results. But again, Amy, as I mentioned, I think our focus is really on, our voter registration, our voter mobilization, and our voter education efforts. I mean, for example, we went down to Atlanta because people in the DNC said that no one was going to support Cynthia McKinney in her election. And our organization and people in our organization went down and just mobilized her campaign. We did something similar in Memphis, Tennessee back in November. And that's how we really got started, by mobilizing energizing the campaign of a civil rights activist who had been working with Dr. King in Memphis, Tennessee to get elected as one of the first Muslims to be elected to the city council in the Bible Belt of Memphis.
In fact, he was your father.
Oh, that's
city
right.
Council. He was my father. Now, he was elected as a result of him suing the city council, right?
Over... That's right. He filed a lawsuit against the city government challenging the at-large voting system as being violative of the Civil Rights or Voting Rights Act. And so therefore, in fact, and the power elite of Memphis opposed him, like Harold Ford and the rest. None of them wanted to support him. And it wasn't until young people actually got involved that we began to get some things accomplished. But again, we want to focus on, for example, our 10-point plan that we have called the Do the Right Thing agenda is focusing upon education. They're spending like $270 billion on education and no money on military and no money on education.
Tlaib Kareem, do you have a number of the National Youth Empowerment Movement that people can get in touch with you?
Yes, our number is 202-806-7007. Again, that's 202-806-7007.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us this morning. I'm sorry it was such a short time. Tlaib Kareem, a communications lawyer here in Washington, D.C., with the National Youth Empowerment Movement. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin. Our engineer has been Kenneth Mason. If you want a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.